From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal, and Arshad Mohammed, U.S. foreign policy correspondent for the Reuters news agency. And here are the issues. President Barack Obama visited Saudi Arabia to reassure Persian Gulf leaders that the United States is not tilting toward Tehran and abandoning longtime Arab partners. A boat carrying hundreds of migrants sank in the Mediterranean, killing at least 500 people. The tragedy followed an agreement between the European Union and Turkey that has stemmed the flow of migrants entering Europe via Greece. In American political news, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton swept the New York primaries, building on hard-to-catch leads for the Republican and Democratic presidential nominations. And finally, U.S. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew announced that the image of a former abolitionist and slave, Harriet Tubman, would replace that of a slave owner and populist president, Andrew Jackson, on the $20 bill. Arshad, let's start with Obama's visit to Saudi Arabia. It did not begin auspiciously. He was greeted at the airport by the governor of Riyadh, not by King Salman. It seemed to follow a pretty carefully prepared script, but I didn't detect any great warmth between Obama and Salman.
So the U.S.-Saudi relationship is commonly dated to 1945, when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt met with King Ibn Saud of Saudi Arabia on the USS Quincy in the Suez Canal, and they essentially struck a bargain, which was that U.S. oil companies would get preferred access to Saudi oil in exchange for which the United States would provide security for the kingdom. So what's changed in 70 years? There have been sort of tectonic shifts in the last, say, decade. One of them is the United States is no longer so dependent on Saudi oil. Another is the effort under the Obama administration to reach out to Iran. And the third is, in Obama, you have a president who is willing to speak quite uncomfortable, I don't know if I'd say truths, but at least views to the Saudis. And his interview in The Atlantic magazine, I think, made a number of officials in the Gulf shudder. He suggested that they were free riders in terms of security. And he suggested that they needed to find a way to share the region with Iran. So what you have is very divergent views on particularly how to deal with Iran. And you're quite right that, you know, the Saudis, who think very hard about protocol, may well have been trying to send a signal in having the governor of Riyadh greet the president. That, you know, all this said, it's not as if these kinds of dealings are based on relationships so much as it is on interests. And the reality is that the United States still wants to protect the flow of oil, whether it's consuming it or whether its allies are consuming it. And the United States wants to find a way to push toward more diplomatic rather than kind of military solutions in the region. So the Gulf leaders may also be looking beyond Obama now. I mean, this is probably his last trip there as president, and maybe his last trip there ever. And they may be thinking about how they may deal with a future President Clinton or President Trump or President whomever.
Yeah. Tom, looking back at how other U.S. presidents have dealt with Saudis, certainly there was more intimacy at various times. I have a memory, strong memory, of George W. Bush walking hand in hand with the late King Abdullah, even though they'd had a terrible row over the Palestinian issue at the time.
Right, and I also remember, Barbara, President George W. Bush, Bush 43, inviting then Saudi Ambassador Prince Bandar bin Sultan to his ranch in Crawford, Texas, and there were pictures of the both of them in blazers and blue jeans and quite a sense of...
Bandar Bush, they used to call him, right?
Yeah. Exactly right. Yeah. He seems to have disappeared from the diplomatic scene. But, of course, Bush's father, President Bush's father, Bush 41, had even closer ties to the Saudis. So there's a long-standing history here. I think the Saudis are really disappointed with President Obama, and I think it goes to Iran, as Arshad has talked about, but it also goes to Syria. I mean, the Saudis seem to be deathly afraid of President Assad of Syria. And I know that it's not that hard to get Saudi diplomats talking without being named about how upset they were when President Obama a couple years ago drew a line in the sand and said, if Assad is using chemical weapons on his own people, we're going to intervene. He was, and they didn't. They're very upset with that. And it's always a tip-off, you know. The language of diplomacy is often very instructive, and I thought it was interesting when the communique from the White House said that the king and the president exchanged views on a variety of topics. It's not suggesting that there was a lot of common ground there. And I think it's also interesting that even though a translator, an interpreter would be required, the king and the president spent 2 hours together. That's a long time, even waiting for translation. So it just tells you there's a lot of baggage. And I think you're exactly right. I think President Obama is going to be president for another 8 months. I mean, I think the global landscape is starting to focus more and more on who's next.
And we're going to talk about that in a minute. But Arshad, going back to this relationship and also Obama's comments, I was at an event the other day where someone suggested that Obama was already giving post-presidential interviews before he left office. And I think even though it's clear he has no great love for Saudi Arabia and no great admiration for its society, it might have been better if he had not said those things to The Atlantic.
Well, historically, presidents usually wait till they leave, and then they don't really usually do it through interviews. They tend to do it through their books, which are usually fairly anodyne. So that was an unusual act. One thing I think is worth noting about President Obama, Tom was talking about tip-offs. An early tip-off with regard to Obama's views came in the speech where he criticized the drive towards war with Iraq in 2002. And in addition to the criticism of that, the war that was then being planned, he also referred to the United States, quote, so-called, unquote, allies in Saudi Arabia and Egypt. That was a very telling remark because it was essentially questioning whether these two countries that are pillars of American security in the Middle East were really a U.S. friend.
Let's take a short break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin with Arshad Mohammed and Tom DeFrank. Tom, you were talking about other areas of friction between our two countries.
Yeah, there's not just a couple. There's many. And one of them we haven't discussed yet is human rights. Human rights is very important to President Obama. He raises it in conversations with leaders who he thinks don't do very well on human rights, President Putin of Russia, the Chinese, of course. It's known that he does not like the Saudi system of justice. He's kind of appalled by beheadings and summary trials and summary
and
executions.
No rights for women or few rights for women.
Right. All that bothers him. And this came up, and the word out of the Saudi embassy before this visit was the king is none too pleased to be lectured about all of this stuff, but it's important to President Obama. That is another source of friction. Another one, though, is the continuing saga of what is in those 28 pages from the 911 Commission's highly classified report about whether the Saudis were or were not involved in helping the 9/11 attackers.
Hijackers. And Arshad, there's a lawsuit about that, right?
Exactly. So this has been much in the news this week in Washington because the Supreme Court ruled this week that a lawsuit against the government of Iran could go forward and essentially ordered the payment of nearly $2 billion in frozen Iranian government assets to victims of Iranian terrorism.
Allegedly. Well, mostly, I believe, in Lebanon and so on, where
correct.
There hasn't been actual proof that the Iranians did it, but Hezbollah.
Correct.
Hezbollah, so that was the groups did it. Yeah.
That's right. The 1983 bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut. The other issue that's been much in the news is talk of legislation that would permit lawsuits to go forward against Saudi Arabia for any alleged Saudi government involvement in 9/11. What's the difference here?
Well, yeah.
the key difference is that previously there had been legislation passed that allowed U.S. claimants to sue countries that had been deemed state sponsors of terrorism. Iran is deemed by the U.S. State Department to be a state sponsor of terrorism. Therefore, that lawsuit could go forward and the Supreme Court could allow for those monies to be paid out to American plaintiffs. In the case of Saudi Arabia, it is not designated as a state sponsor of terrorism. Therefore, there is not a legal basis to seize their assets or make claims against them. And therefore, this legislation that's pending on the Hill, and my colleagues who've reported on this suggest it's not really actually going anywhere despite the hue and the cry, is out there to essentially strip Saudi Arabia of its sovereign immunity, its immunity from such lawsuits. But as I say, my colleague who tracks this carefully says it does not appear to be making any headway.
Well, if I were in Iran and I were writing stories about this, I would be screaming double standard pretty clearly, and I'm sure that they will. But I want to turn to another topic and really a great tragedy. Tom, you know that this deal was reached between the European Union and Turkey to block the flow primarily of Syrian and Iraqi and Afghan refugees that had been taking little boats from Turkey to an island in islands in Greece and then from there moving on into the European Union. Now a boat has capsized, something like 500 migrants have died in the Mediterranean going from Libya, trying to go from Libya to Italy, which has been another route. It never ends. If you stop it in one area, it seems to come up in another.
Well, this is a terrible tragedy, and it's very interesting that according to news reports, Barbara, that none of the victims on this freighter, which is apparently put together by human traffickers, and these very poor people paid more than $1,500 U.S., for this passage to freedom, and most of them died. But the most interesting thing to me was there were very few, if any, Syrians or Afghans or people like that there. They were Africans. They were Somalis, Egyptians, Sudanese, Eritreans. And that just tells you that there are even more people around the globe desperate to get to freedom in Western Europe, and so desperate that they probably have spent their life savings trying to flee, not in this case, not necessarily oppression, but deprivation. And so this puts pressure on the European Union, it puts pressure on the Greeks and the Turks, and it's just, I don't know what's going to happen, because I agree with you. I don't think these so-called freedom flotillas are going to stop no matter where they're coming from.
Arshad, what about NATO? What about the Italian Navy? I mean, I thought there were supposed to be more patrols to catch people like this. Apparently, these people died, many of them, when they were being transferred from one overloaded boat to another overloaded boat in the middle of the Mediterranean.
That's right. There has been talk about NATO doing more to try to stop these kinds of flows, but clearly that hasn't materialized in a way, at least to prevent this particular event. The first-person descriptions of what happened are really quite heartrending because, as you say, there was a smaller boat that where the people were told that they would be transferred to a bigger boat. When they got near the bigger boat, it was already overloaded. And according to one first-person account that I read, the smugglers, the human traffickers, essentially just abandoned the people there. And in one case, a man said that the smuggler captain, brandished a knife and threatened to kill if other people tried to get on his boat, and he then radioed and was picked up by another boat and sped away and left everyone else to their fate with nothing but a cell phone with which they apparently called the Italian Navy. So I tend to share the view that flows of this sort, kind of like flows of water, are going to find routes. If one gets closed off, others are likely to appear.
At the same time, it does appear that this effort to control the flow out of Turkey is working. A big diminution in the numbers of people trying to get to Greece from Turkey. Yeah.
Yes, that's absolutely right, at least according to all the data I've seen about it.
Time for another break. We'll be right back with more issues in the news.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.
Welcome back. I'm Barbara Slavin with Tom DeFrank and Arshad Mohammed. Tom, let's turn to American politics, a big, big primary in New York. Usually New York is not so important, but this time it really was. Trump, is he now back on course, and can anyone stop him?
Well, yes and maybe. Yes, he is back on course after being hammered in the Wisconsin primary and badly embarrassed by Senator Ted Cruz. Trump finally had to start listening to advisors who said, okay.
He has some grown-ups in the room now, right?
Exactly right, adults.
Yeah.
And they have said to him, you could lose this because rules of political conventions are very arcane. They're very intricate. A lot of delegates have to vote for you on the first ballot, but if it goes beyond that, they're going to go somewhere else. Just as a quick aside, I had dinner recently with a governor of a Republican state who is committed to Senator Marco Rubio, who isn't even in the race anymore. And by state law in this state, the governor has to be committed to Marco Rubio on two ballots. There are other states with one ballot committed. There's others that are three ballots. And so you've got all these rules, and Trump finally has figured out now it's time to spend some real money, not on ads, not on polls, but on organizing from the ground up and making sure that delegates who you have already won, and he's got the lion's share of delegates, making sure that they will stick with him. And so he's finally spending upwards of about $20 million on nuts and bolts organizing. And that's an important factor. The other thing is that he won big in New York, which had 95 delegates, and the gold standard was 80. If he didn't get 80, he would be in problem. Well, he got 86 out of 95, and so he did, quote, better than expected in the expectation games. And so now reporters are not saying, is Trump dead or almost dead? They're saying he's now regained his momentum. And Trump is now saying, there will not be two ballots. I will have enough delegates, 1,237, before the convention, so it's not going to be a problem. We will see. And in the days to come, there are primaries in the East where he is very strong, like Pennsylvania and Delaware and Rhode Island and New Jersey. He's going to do very, very well there. I mean, some people say it's going to come down to Indiana, which is a very conservative Republican state, and that will be Senator Cruz's last stand. We'll see. The other thing I want to say very quickly is about Hillary Clinton. She blew away Senator Bernie Sanders, two New Yorkers. And the real question here is what does Senator Sanders want? I mean, it is all but mathematically impossible for him to win the nomination away from Senator Clinton. The real question is he now going to start behaving like a Democratic adult? Is he is he going to quit bashing her, beating her up, and saying she's not qualified for president, and making fun of her for taking $300,000 speeches from Wall Street bankers? You've got two contenders here who have high negatives, who have to figure out how they're going to change their tone.
Yeah.
Senator Clinton doesn't have to change her tone, but Sanders has to if he wants to have a future in the Democratic Party. And Donald Trump is starting to change his tone already. He's not so much calling Ted Cruz lying Ted anymore. He's calling him
once in a while.
Once in a while he can't help himself, but he's trying to call him Senator Cruz and Governor Kasich. And so they're both trying to behave, but the bottom line is I still think it is Clinton's to lose and Trump's to lose. And they could, but not as likely as they were a week ago.
What can you say about this?
Well, there was a question I wanted to ask Tom about this, which is, if it happens to be that Trump does not get 1,237 delegate votes before the convention, how much of a backlash do you think there may be against the party and Republican candidates generally if he were to be denied the nomination and the Republicans were to put someone else forward, how much is that going to hurt generally in November?
I think it's going to hurt a lot our shot. I mean, I've said for a while the Republicans have a civil war on their hands no matter how this comes out, because if Trump wins, you've got a large number of establishment Republicans and a lot of Republican voters who are going to say, we're doomed, he's going to drive us right off a cliff. If somehow he does not make it, does not be the nominee, his people who are angry already will say, our guy was denied because of some petty little rule or some backroom rule shenanigans or something like that. And I think that's going to be a problem for the party. I don't buy the notion that Hillary Clinton is the great Satan is going to be enough to unify the Republican Party. It might be if Donald Trump is the nominee, but if Trump is denied, I just think it's not going to be a great year for Republicans, no matter how this sorts out, because one way or the other, you're going to have a lot of anger and bitterness in that party on all sides.
One thing that I was struck by, Tom, there's a new, the adult in the room is a guy named Paul Manafort, right, who has long, long history as a Republican operative, and he, at some meeting of the Republican National Committee in Florida, apparently said that everything Trump had been doing so far was an act, and that, you know, this was all just part of the sort of game plan of getting the nomination and so on, suggesting that you could put another script in front of Trump and he would somehow reemerge as a responsible adult.
Well, he's smart enough to know that all candidates at some point have to pivot. And I think once Trump concludes that he's going to be the nominee, if in fact he is the nominee, I think he will start behaving, or at least trying to behave a little better. I mean, he keeps saying, I will be so presidential, it'll be so boring you won't believe it. But we'll see about that. It's hard to believe that Donald Trump, who has had a career of being a billionaire, blowhard, blustering bully, is going to have a personality transplant. He might have a politically motivated transplant, but it's not going to be a real one.
Yeah. Well, he's learning how to use teleprompters better, I understand. So we will see what the new improved Trump looks like. But Arshad, I wanted to turn to another domestic story in the United States, which has some real significance, I think, for people around the world. We have all this money here in the U.S. that's very popular around the world, and it's all covered with old white men, yeah? And that's going to change.
Yeah, so the news on this was that the U.S. Treasury Department announced a number of changes to American currency. Probably the one that has jumped out at most people is the replacement of Andrew Jackson, who was a slave owner, a $20 bill on the front of it, with Harriet Tubman, who was an abolitionist, an African-American woman who was born into slavery and who, at great risk to herself, after escaping, went back into the South to free not just her own family, but other slaves. You know, currencies are, in a certain sense, about telling a national story and about iconography. And the notion that you would replace, as you say, a white man with an African-American woman is a pretty potent iconographic signal. The other thing I think that one really has to think about in this is that this is part of a much broader conversation in the American society. You've seen it in universities around the country. There was a huge debate this year at Princeton University about Woodrow Wilson, its founder.
Yeah.
I see this even at my kids' high school, where there are endless debates over how you recognize, treat, show respect for, honor the history of all, you know, racial and ethnic mixes. So it's an interesting move.
Tom, she was apparently called Moses for her work on the Underground Railway. And after she finished with her abolitionist work, she went on to be a member of the suffragette movement as well, working with women like Susan B. Anthony and so on. So she really is a civil rights icon writ large, yeah?
She is an American icon who has not gotten a lot of attention. There's some critics are already lining up to say this is just political correctness, and some say this is all about the fact that Hillary Clinton is having real problems with attracting women voters, especially young women voters. My basic view is this is not going to happen until 2020, but Harriet Tubman was a real deal, a real icon, and it's time. it's time for this.
Well, I think with that, that's all the time we have. Joining us today, we're Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal, and Arshad Mohammed, U.S. foreign policy correspondent for Reuters News Agency. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski, and our engineers were Wagner Roberts and Linus Rimkus. I'm Barbara Slavin, acting director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.